Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, oh, it's a cracker. I sat down with Johnny Dean of Menswear, and I'd recorded with Johnny before on the Hardcore Listening podcast, and he's such a fascinating guy, and I knew this was going to be good, and it really is, and you're going to have a wonderful time listening to this. It's super funny, and we go to some places that I didn't think we'd go, and if you're a fan of Peter Gabriel, then I suggest you listen out for the Gabriel chat. Before we get on with this podcast, just a quick thanks to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network, and also thanks to 76 for producing this podcast. If this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, then when you get to the end, go and have a look in the archives as well, because there's over 150 episodes with some of your favourite musicians, actors, comedians, producers, all talking about their creative journeys and the records that have soundtracked it. So you can go and listen to bundles of stuff over there. As well as that, I do have a Patreon page where you can support this podcast as well and get access to a further 150 or so episodes and radio shows and videos, episodes and stuff. You can find out about all of this at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Anyway, let's get back to today's episode. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with Johnny Dean.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Right, we're recording. Sitting opposite me today is Johnny Dean of Menswear. Hello, Johnny.
Hello.
Well, this is, we've already pressed record, and then we are recording on one of the hottest days of the year. And so Johnny has been walking around his house, turning off various fans, and he's currently sporting a kind of kimono. I thought Hugh Hefner, you went for Bruce Lee stroke.
Lawrence from Denham.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I've got lockdown hair as well.
Oh, your hair's looking good, mate.
Yeah, I don't know. Needs a cut. Look, it's turning into like a bob.
It's all right. You're wearing it well.
Whoa. I feel this heat is disgusting. This is the only word for it, isn't it?
We've already discussed the fact that Johnny's feeling oppressed by the weather at the moment.
It is oppressive. It's horrible. I'm an Englishman. Can't be dealing with this shit.
Well, we've not seen each other for a couple of years. Last time I saw you, Johnny, was when you come on the Hardcore Listening podcast shortly after Bowie had died, and you counted down your top five Bowie records. So I'll be interested to know if he's going to feature.
That was a classic podcast for anyone who's missed that. That's classic.
It was really good, and it was and ever since then. We actually recorded top five rock and roll documentaries a little while ago, and both Chris and I both said, sort of reflected back on the chat we had with you, and said a film about Menswear will be the most epic rock and roll film ever.
I don't know, you know, I think a lot of people would have problems believing it,
yeah,
for a start, and I'm a bit worried it'd end up like that Bross documentary. No, I think it could go that way quite easily.
What did you make of that?
Oh, I thought it was amazing. That for me is one of the top. That would be in my top five music documentaries. Easily would be in there. It could even be number one. I've never seen the likes of that. It was incredible.
It's the fact that, I guess, you know, if you watch one about the Who or Fleetwood Mac or these kind of rock and roll giants, there's moments where there's, you know, drugs and people die and it's like a tirade of emotions. That Bros one also gave me a bundle of emotions that I still haven't worked out.
I know what you mean. I was pretty speechless, but there was a. It's just some of the. It's so quotable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's more. It's probably got more quotes than Spinal Tap, and that's a mockumentary.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. It's phenomenal. If and people listening to this haven't seen that Bros documentary, you really must see it because it is something else.
It's something else.
I mean. When they start going on about Conkers. Conkers, mate. It is so brilliant.
I think he's so...
And they don't know, do they? They don't seem to know
no.
how funny they are.
That's the genius. It's like when you know, people tuned into the Office for the first season and thought they were watching a documentary and were like, hang on. And it was... If you just stumbled across that, you'd think it was a mockumentary because people don't. People are more self-aware than that.
Yeah, and people don't say those things either. No. Normal people. People have had normal lives. Don't say those kind of things. It is gold. I bet the guy making that must have been like, "This is gold."
Yeah, like. And it looked like he didn't have to push too hard to get that gold.
No. He didn't have to dig too deep, did he?
There must be some incredible outtakes there. The stuff that like didn't make the cut because through fear of just being too horrible. Like, I don't
know. Or just out there.
Yeah.
I mean, they're pretty eccentric guys as well, I think.
Yeah.
Those two.
Conkers, mate.
Conkers, mate. You know, Conkers, it's banned. You're not allowed to play Conkers. We've got to do something.
Right, let's talk records. Johnny, the song with the greatest ever intro.
Yeah, so I'm going to go back to Bowie and say Station to Station.
Oh, nice.
Which is just, I mean, it's a very long intro, but it's great how it builds. It's like a slow build. And the song has a lot of changes anyway, but I just really, really like the intro. Very moody. It's kind of like post-Barrett Pink Floyd in a way.
Yeah.
It's like a prog song, that. You wouldn't look odd on a prog album. And it always reminds me of the film Christiana F. Have you seen that?
No.
Okay, it's about... it's a German film, classic, and it's about... teenagers on the street in Berlin in the 70s on heroin. So it's a jolly subject. It's based on a true story, actually. And there's a bit in it where they go to a Bowie concert, and it's that whole beginning, but live, of Station to Station, but on this huge stage. And it's just incredible. It's just an amazing sequence. And Bowie walks on during this intro, you know, to come and do his lyrics, to do his singing part, and he looks so good. He looks probably the coolest he ever did. Nice. And he's kind of done up like a kind of James Dean Rebel Without a Cause, that kind of the red Harrington and jeans. He just looks the dogs. And it's with that intro, it just works so well. You should watch that if you're up for being really depressed one evening.
Oh, I love a bit of bleak British cinema, mate. Or German, even.
This is German, yeah. But it's brilliant even just for that. So I think you'd probably be able to see that sequence on YouTube because people love it. It's really, really good. But that intro is fantastic.
So I always ask musicians about intros. And when you'd approach writing intros... I guess when, you know, you put together I Manage Somehow and Daydream, what was the intro something that you was kind of like key to? What was radio a consideration? And I know obviously you still make music yourself in the studio and stuff. And how do you approach writing music now as you would have back then? Because there's so many ways that people listen to music now that is different to you know, the way that people would hear about music and find out about new records, you know, in the formative years of Menswear. So I just want to know how you approached it back then, and was there pressure from a label to kind of give you, you know, because there was a lot of indie music, it was very sort of lots of pop sensibilities in British indie music around the time of Menswear and the Britpop, you know, scene. So it's a very long-winded question here, Johnny. And I've been doing this question for about 2 years, and I still can't quite nail the question how I want it to sound. But what was the sort of approach to it?
With our early songs, we didn't really consider it at all because, I mean, Daydreaming, we wrote in a bloke's kitchen in Dagenham. He thought he managed us, and he kind of did a Andrew Lou Goldman and said, "I'm going out to work, and you're staying in the kitchen, and I'm locking in our house, and I want you to have written a song by the time I come back," and buggered off. There was no food in there or anything in this house. So in the end, all we could do was do that, and we wrote Daydreamer.
Who was that, you and Chris?
Me, Chris, and Stuart.
Yeah.
And we didn't consider at that point, we weren't even a full band then. It was basically just the three of us.
Yeah.
And I didn't even think it wasn't clear cut that I was going to get a deal or anything. Or it was, you know, ending up on the radio or in the charts was just insane, really. I didn't actually think all this is going to end up in the charts or anything. We just wrote these songs.
Had the hustling started by then? Were you around the clubs telling everyone you were pop stars?
At that point, it was starting we wrote some songs. But yeah, I mean, it's the first song I've ever been involved in, that Daydreamer, in my whole life, and it went to number 14, so I didn't expect that to happen. No one's going to expect that to happen. To be honest, I didn't know that Menswear was going to do what it did. I would have been happy just to have plodding along being a little kind of indie band.
Yeah.
But everything just, at that point in the 90s, everything just went mental. I mean, it really went quite mental. There was so much money being thrown around that anyone who was looked a certain way, had a certain haircut, you could get a deal easily.
It's crazy. Last weekend I went away and I don't know if you've read it, but I read a book. I can't remember what it's called. Phil Savage.
About his time at Savage and Best and Britpop. And
yeah. Have you read it?
No, but I've heard about it.
I mean, it's quite gross. Like, you know, it doesn't sort of depict that industry very kindly.
At that point it was pretty, it was like, you know, infested with sharks.
Yeah. Basically. And that comes across you know, as I interpret it, he doesn't come across very well either.
He's all right, Phil, but yeah, he's a businessman.
Yeah. Yeah, that's apparent. And by the sounds of things, quite a good one.
He knows his stuff.
Yeah, and and that was it. And let's pick up on that a little bit later, because I want to know about that kind of impact of fame and a little bit later. But let's kind of go back to the sort of earlier times first, because for track two, Johnny, I'm going to ask you the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
This one's easy. This was very easy because it's this song blew me away when I first heard it, and I would have been about seven years old. It's Our Friends Electric by Gary Newman.
Right.
And the first, I can even remember where I was. I was on a landing of the house we lived in a little village called Great Wakering in Essex. tiny little place. And I was standing on the landing, and my brothers used to listen to the charts. They were a lot older than me, and they used to sit in their bedroom and listen to the charts and tape it. Bruno Brooks. And I can remember just standing there and that coming out of the bedroom, this like basically like a wall of synths just coming out there and just thinking, what is that? Because it didn't sound like anything I'd really heard before. I mean, it just sounds enormous, that record. I mean, there's hardly that much on it, but the synths make it sound really, really, really big.
It's such a fat sounding synth.
Yeah, it? Yeah. And it just blew my, it literally, it just blew, took my head off. And I was just like, wow. You know, that's when I first realized that in it, sort of something in me clicked, like a little cog turned. And I just knew that's the kind of thing that I wanted to do one day. But yeah, that record.
What was the emotion? Important.
Just awe, I think. Real awe. And just kind of a little bit confused, because I've never really heard anything like it before. Yeah. I mean, it was a pretty out there for its time, yeah. And it pretty groundbreaking. I mean, I'd never heard of John Fox had already been doing stuff like this with Ultravox a bit, but I hadn't heard that stuff. My brothers didn't know about that. They weren't playing that John Fox stuff, so I didn't know about that. So Newman was the first time I really heard synths being used in a rock and roll, really heavy industrial way, where it just overwhelms you.
Did you get to see like him doing that on Top of the Pops or anything? Can you remember when you first saw Newman?
Yeah, definitely. I can remember seeing him on the television and just thinking he looked really, really strange.
Yeah.
Yeah, like really odd.
Was you kind of drawn to that? Like,
Yeah, very. And I always have been. But as a kid, the first thing I remember seeing, the first musician I remember seeing on television that made an impact on me was Mark Bolan when I was really young. And obviously he didn't look quite regular for the time in glam. I thought at first he was just this lady.
Yeah.
this blouse with long hair. It took me a while to figure out, you know, actually that's a bloke.
Yeah.
I think that's the first time I realized that was a job as well. People did that for it as a job. And I just thought, yeah, that's pretty cool. Imagine doing that as a job.
Yeah, I'll have a bit of that.
Yeah, my dad comes home knackered. You know, he doesn't look that guy. He looks like he's having the time of his life.
Yeah.
And that looks,
he was.
It also kind of looks really easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it isn't, obviously, but compared to someone slogging it,
so
it's an easy job compared to a lot of jobs.
So you mentioned older brothers and stuff and your folks and that. Was there lots of music on at home growing up?
Yeah. I mean, they were quite a lot older than me. My parents, weirdly, didn't really play music at all. My dad didn't have any music at all. I think he had some cassettes that someone had done for him in like the 1960s or something.
Yeah.
My mum had a few, like, soundtrack albums for musicals, mm-hmm. like West Side Story and stuff. And hair, but yeah, it was mainly my education musically came through my older brothers and the stuff they were listening to. That had a bigger impact on me.
And
also one of my brothers was a huge Beatles fan well before the 90s and stuff, when it became far more popular.
People forget that it was uncool to like the Beatles for quite a long time, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, they were a pop band.
Yeah.
They were a very commercial pop band. People forget that. People look at them now as if they were, at the time, they were seen as this alternative, amazing thing, but they weren't. They were a pop band. They were a boy band with guitars. They really, really were. You know, I remember reading that when they started to change and write music, thinking about writing and stuff around the time of Revolver. Apparently Bob Dylan, they played it to Bob Dylan and he was like, I get it, you don't want to be cute anymore.
Really?
Yeah, because he saw, even though he was kind of jealous of their success, to him they were again just this
boy band.
Plastic boy band type affair. You know, they weren't making really good music that he considered to be, you know,
worthy. Yeah.
Which was what Lennon always wanted to happen. Yeah. He always wanted to do that. And McCartney. Now they're seen as that.
Mm. That's a really good point. Like, you know, I guess they were a boy band, and people look at them now as Radiohead, and, you know, this, like, kind of progressive.
I mean, obviously, they were groundbreaking. They did a lot of things first, but a lot of that's down as much to their producer as it was then.
I think it's interesting, though, when you look at the time span the Beatles existed in and the progression within that time period is ridiculous.
You know, and
to release such a vast amount of music that was evolving, I guess evolving as technology was evolving, and obviously, as you mentioned, like, you know, what George Martin was, you know, obviously sort of messing with as well. And I don't know if there's that many bands that have put out such a huge body of work in a short space of time. That's maybe the Smiths, you know.
I think it. A lot of it is down to them being first.
Yeah.
You know, if you're the first band like that, the first big pop band, everything you do is going to kind of be new.
Yeah. You set the benchmark. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of, that was kind of an advantage for them in a way.
Mm.
But you can't deny that once they started knocking out, like, 1966 and after that, some of the stuff they did was just insanely good.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine what it must have been like to hear a lot of it on the radio for the first time.
Can you imagine, like, hearing Tomorrow Never Knows for the first time?
Yeah, it would have been mad. It would have been insane. It would have blown your tiny mind easily. Yeah. It would have been shocking.
Hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry. It won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track Podcast, and you can listen to all the songs, because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. And
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. I'm going to talk school, Johnny, and I want to know the song that reminds you of your time at school.
My school was quite far away. You know Essex. My school was in Rochford.
Okay. So that's a bit of a trek from Wakering.
Yeah, from Wakering. So it's quite a long way. And we used to have to get these.
Is this coaches. Secondary school, Johnny?
This is, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't really, musically, the reason I remember, I have a lot of music I remember school, my secondary school about, is because on these coach journeys, they would be playing Radio 1 to keep us all happy on this journey. And, so, you know, I was hearing all the you'd hear all the pop music all the time. So on the way to school and on the way home from school. And so a lot of songs I remember come from that, to do with remembering school, come from that specifically. And there are songs that when I hear them, I'll think straight away of school immediately.
Okay.
And I'd have to say Sledgehammer's one of them.
Okay.
Peter Gabriel, Sledgehammer. Every time I hear that song, I can remember suddenly I'm in my history class talking about it with someone. And it's kind of, it's a great song. And I can remember that maybe one of the reasons it's so stuck in my head is that it had this video that at the time, the stop frame animation video, that was quite amazing at the time. It was a big deal, you know, in the 80s.
It was a huge deal, that video, wasn't it, when it came out?
People put a lot of effort into videos then, because MTV was the way most people were sort of consuming music at the time. So that I can remember that video really, really well. But recently, I can remember I was listening to Sledgehammer, I've got this nagging thing going on, and I'm just going to ask you if you feel the same way, or if you think this could be right. It's packed full of sexual innuendo, that song, for a start. It really is. If you listen to the lyrics, it's basically, for me, it sounds like he's just talking about Jiggy. But I think Sledgehammer, I think Peter Gabriel, that's his penis. I think his Sledgehammer is Peter Gabriel's penis.
Yeah.
And I think, you know how people, you know, some blokes have a name for their penis.
Yeah.
And I think Peter Gabriel.
I said that really quickly then.
Peter Gabriel, I think his nickname for his penis is Sledgehammer. And I'm convinced that song is about his penis. I really am. I'm convinced. No one can change my mind on this. You must listen to that.
I'm just literally going through the lyrics in my head. You could be well on the money there.
I think he is. I think it's code.
Yeah.
I think the only person probably who knows is Kate Bush.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I think
it's
that's
really
what it
weird because that, I mean, I remember getting that album. That was one of them kind of mid-80s huge production albums.
Yeah.
And getting, it's called So, wasn't it, the album? And on the strength of Sledgehammer and obviously the Kate Bush track. And I haven't listened to it for years. I remember once, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I heard REM covering Red Rain from that album. And I thought, I'll give that a listen. I never went back to it. And then about a year ago, Harry Styles covered Sledgehammer.
Did he?
Yeah.
There you go. Maybe he thinks this is about the penis.
Right.
Because he's quite penis-centric, I believe. Is that a thing?
That's not a word. That's not a word.
Well, it's one of those things you hear a lot of rumours about in the rock and roll world, and Harry Styles is one of these people that it's constantly rumoured about his todger being bigger than the normal. I don't know how I know this. It's just some, you know, you just hear these things.
I don't care.
So maybe that's like, maybe Sledgehammer.
It brought out the term penis-centric. I'm all over that.
Well, that's what it all seems to be about with that guy, from what I can tell. I'm not sure it's his records.
I couldn't tell you anything about him, but I saw a thing and he was wearing some kind of weird woolly tank top. And he was always singing Sledgehammer. And so I pressed play and I just thought, and it's a competent cover. And I just thought, right, I'm now going to go and listen to Sledgehammer. Oh my God. Like,
it's so good, isn't
it? It's so good. You know, it's one of them records that I heard, you know, a million times in the 80s. And it's just sounds great to the point where.
Massive as well.
I think
it's so big.
Has it gone, you know, long enough that I could maybe get away with playing that at the Pink Toothbrush? Would the youngsters now be into it? I don't know.
I don't know. The kids seem to be back into Phil Collins, so
yeah,
from what I've heard. So maybe so.
Was you a fan of maybe so? I see what you've done there. So was you a fan of Genesis, like the earlier stuff?
It's something I never really found I could get into Genesis. I don't know why. Not even the later stuff. I don't know why. I do like what Peter Gabriel did around the period of Sledgehammer. And you know what? The weird thing is we recorded our first album in his studio.
Oh, did you?
So, yeah, so we were bumping into him all the time. So that was really ultra weird for me.
Is that in Bath?
Yeah, that's right. It's in a village called Box. Mm.
How was he?
You know, can you imagine me wanting to say to him, Sledgehammer about your knob? <not? laughs> That's all I can think. Hello, Peter. Oh, yes, yeah, lovely to meet you. Sledgehammer, is that about your knob?
No problem. Okay, bye-bye.
But he's got this weird thing. He's got these eyes that when he's looking, talking to you, he looks right at you, well, obviously, but his eyes, they're piercing. It's really creepy. It's like you feel like he's trying to maybe sort of hypnotize you or something. He's got this very, you know, he's got his eyes and the way he is, you can tell that he wasn't going to do anything else but what he's doing.
He seems like an intense fella.
Yeah. But he was actually really, really quite nice and lovely, which I didn't, you know, just normal, really.
But just going back to school momentarily, like...
I don't want to go back to school.
How was it?
Like your kids in lock-in. Oh, God. School, I didn't really like school. I didn't like it. Not for any other reason other than I didn't like people telling me what to do with my time.
Mm.
I had a real problem with it. I spent quite a bit of time in corridors, I think. I wasn't really naughty, but I just had problems concentrating and stuff. And I just didn't like it.
Was you a creative kid?
Yeah, very. The one thing I was good at school and excelled at was art, definitely. I was known for it there at my school for being quite good at art. And I took all my exams in art very early. I did my first O-level when I was 12.
Wow.
So
that was encouraged?
Yeah. And then I did another O-level in art after that. And then I did an A-level all early whilst I was at secondary school.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was very, very creative. But I had a problem with concentration, which is still with me today. I can't stay focused on something unless I'm really, really into it.
Yeah.
And then I get too focused, if that makes sense.
So I can now see what Peter Gabriel would have done your head in then.
Oh, his eyes, they're just, seriously, I think he's a witch, maybe. You know. Sledgehammer. I've got to apologise now to people listening. I've actually brought this down to talking about Harry Styles' knob and stuff. I can't help myself.
So did you want to be an artist when you was at school? Had you had sort of a fascination?
Not really.
Had you developed a fascination with pop stars?
Yeah. I think I always really, even in the back of my head, because you don't think it's going to actually happen, I always wanted to be in a pop band. I wanted to be on Top of the Pops. That's what I wanted to do when I was a kid, massively.
So
more than anything, easily.
This is one of my favourite things to ask guests on here that have appeared on Top of the Pops. For somebody, you know, we're very similar in age, Johnny, and obviously anyone of our generation, Top of the Pops was such a important part of your week. You know, it's the only place you got to see your pop stars and, you know, and hopefully get to hear some of the records that you probably couldn't afford to buy from the shops. How was it for you to be in a car going to perform on Top of the Pops and obviously performing on Top of the Pops? How was that day?
The first time was amazing. I mean, the excitement levels are through the roof, really. You know, you feel like, this is it, I've done it, I guess, in a way. Just to think to be on it once was a big deal for me, to just be on that. You know, even if I'd only did it once, I could die happy.
Yeah.
And we were lucky enough to go back more times. Unfortunately, it's one of those things that gets really old very, very quickly.
What do you mean?
Because 90% of Top of the Pops was sitting around all day with nothing to do. 90% of it, then 10% was the actual performing, you know, going on and actually singing, which they used to make you sing live in those days when I was on it. So you'd get that, and that would be great, wonderful, brilliant. And they'd make sure they had fans in the audience and stuff. Maybe never noticed how sometimes everyone seems to be dancing a lot because they actually used to get fans in. But yeah, it can get old really quickly. And the BBC, you know, I don't know if they've changed now, but they used to have a lot of, they like to do things their way all the time and stuff. And sometimes it could get a little bit, you know, I don't know, maybe we were spoiled. We just got bored too quickly because we were so, oh, not this again. Oh, Top of the Pops. It's weird, isn't it? It's, when you're a kid, it's the only thing you want. And when you get it, you try and just kind of spoil it by acting like a dick.
when you first went on there, was there something unique about you going on with Our Manager somehow? Was it?
Yeah. It's the first time anyone had been on Top of the Pops ever without having released a record. We hadn't released a record at all, and we did that just before, about a week before.
I mean, that's fucking incredible, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's history. It's BBC history. So that is cool. It is pretty cool. It's incredible. But we did this kind of thing. We did this. London Records were excellent with that kind of thing, with TV plug-in. They were in with everyone. They were so good, the TV pluggers there. And they got us to, when they made Top of the Pops, moved to Elstree from Television Centre, moved out to Elstree where they do EastEnders and Grange Hill. And when they first built the set, they wanted to test it out, but they needed to have a band to test out all the different stages with all the different cameras and lights. And so London Records got us to do it for them. So in a way, we kind of done them a favour. And I guess it was almost like a return favour.
Yeah.
And also the guy, Rick Blackshill, who was producing Top of the Pops at the time, had come to see us play live. And he was really up for having us on. And of course, he was the first producer to do that as well. So that kind of looks good to him, to have done that. But yeah, he was very involved in all that kind of Britpop taking over Top of the Pops at the time. That was very much down to Rick Blackshill because he was very into that. I think it was his decision that all singers had to sing live.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing, I guess.
I remember it being so exciting. I remember, obviously we discussed this on the Hardcore Listening podcast, but I didn't know you. I knew that you'd come to my club, you know, a fair bit, but we'd never spoken. But I did spend quite a lot of time with the guitarist in Menswear, Chris, and I remember sort of hearing that Menswear were going to be on Top of the Pops, and it was like, the first person I know is going to be on Top of the Pops. This is crazy. And and at the time, you know, all we'd heard was hype, you know, about this band. And we'd seen the big spread in Select magazine. And it was like, wow, this is mental. And then to see it, it felt really exciting. It felt, it felt punk. It felt like this is a band that, you know, haven't released the record and did you feel like you'd sort of tried to seize and maximise that moment?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this was do or die. So I just thought, I'm just going to go for this, piss and vinegar.
Yeah.
I got the most complaints that week as well, I think, with BBC received. I got quite a high amount of complaints for throwing my mic stand into the audience.
Really?
Yeah, at the end, I threw my mic stand into the audience and never saw that mic stand again, by the way. So someone in that audience smuggled it out.
Brilliant.
Somehow it was collapsible.
Yeah.
So I got a few complaints as well. And I lashed out at 1 minute with my foot at the cameraman. There's a bit where I kick at the camera and I think it upset a few old ladies or something.
Brilliant. That's what you're meant to do, right? Go on Top of the Pops. You want to upset some old ladies.
I just went into full Leiden mode.
Yeah.
Well, let's give kids something to watch.
Can you remember who else you was on alongside?
Who I was on there with?
Yeah, what other bands?
Hole, I remember a lot. I remember Hole, yeah. We were on there with Hole. And this actually was the start of the friendship between Chris and Eric from Hole.
Yeah.
It continued, and it might still continue to this day, I think, maybe. I don't know, but they became quite good friends.
Yeah.
Which is really weird. But, yeah, I can remember Hole. I remember she was just completely out of her face.
Yeah.
Ant and Dec were doing the seeging, the introducing the bands between songs. They were doing the hosting for it. Ant and Dec, who were apparently, by the way, really big Menswear fans as well.
Right.
And whoever wrote their what they had to say on the autocue, the links, whatever, really fucked them over, because they called Courtney Love when they introduced Hole. They said, "This is Kurt Cobain's widow, Courtney Love." And
fuck,
I was sat
off,
in,
really?
Yeah, no, that really happened. And I was sat in makeup at the time, and I just looked up at the screen and went, "What the fuck did they just say?" And yeah, she just went, "Wait a minute," and just stopped everything. She was going, "Cut, cut, you can't fucking say that." She went absolutely mental. And they just read it off the autocue, and she's screaming at the middle. Poor little Ant and Dec just standing there going, "That was for this." I mean, she was scary.
Yeah.
You know, she was very, very frightening.
You wouldn't want to be on the wrong end of her, would
you?
Yeah,
and basically they had to redo the whole thing. But yeah, I could not believe that. I was like, "Oh no, this is going to kick off."
Yeah.
She went absolutely batshit.
And rightly so, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it was really insensitive. I couldn't believe it. Even the lady in the makeup place was like, "This is, oh my God, how could they have said that?"
Yeah.
Cook of Owens Widow, Courtney Love.
Track 4, Johnny. Wow. The first song you remember buying from a record shop.
This was a difficult one, actually, because I don't really remember this. And I've been asked it before, and the best I can come up with is it was either Beat It in 1982, Michael Jackson, or Do They Know It's Christmas, which was 1984.
Yeah.
It's one of them. No real particular reason.
So where was record shopping for you back then?
Probably somewhere really lame, like W.H. Smith's.
Yeah.
Like most, I was only little. Yeah, on the corner there.
Yeah.
And then as I got older, there was a H&V, which used to be in a big department store called Keddies before it moved.
On the corner.
Yeah, and then it moved to Queen Street, is it, where Golden Disc used to be?
I think Golden Disc is still there.
No, it went ages ago.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I think it's still
there. I think it went. Is it?
Mm.
Well, that was like the place you worked up to as you got older.
Yeah.
So you kind of started maybe at W.H. Smith's, then HMV and Kiddies, maybe our price up to High Street. And then finally, when you went to college...
You started to go to
Golden Disc in Southend, which was a very well-known independent record store. And that store, as well as Southend, is actually all included in the Every Day's Like Sunday video.
That's right.
Yeah. So that shop, they go in record shop.
Mm.
That is Golden Disc, which is infamous.
Yeah.
But that's what I worked up to. That was when I knew I'd graduated to full indie boy status.
You'd earned your stripes.
Yeah.
Can you remember the first time you saw one of your records in a record shop?
One of mine?
Yeah.
No, I don't. What do you mean? Do I remember?
Can you remember walking in and going, "Fucking hell, there's a Menswear record"?
No. No, I didn't do that.
You sound like, you know, that would be vain to do that. Do you think so?
It's just weird. It's just weird to me. I mean, I remember going past Tower Records in London, and they had a huge window display when we brought out the album Nuisance, and that was that to me. It was a real head swivel. I really sort of did my head in. Really, if anything, I was like, "Oh my God, that's a lot." It's a bit much.
It's a bit much. Can you take that down, window? Please?
Please take that down. Come on, have some decency. And I just felt it felt. Do you know, it's kind of weird. Sometimes you can feel a little bit embarrassed, you know, especially if you're seen in a shop looking at something like that, and then someone sees you looking at your own record in a record shop. You know what I mean? That's going to end up straight in the letters page of NME the next week, and you're going to look like a bit of a dick.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that fear of that getting caught, probably stopped me. I was far too cool for that, Stuart. far too cool. Far too cool customer for that kind of nonsense. That's amateur behaviour.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've never even bought mine. I mean, that would be even worse. Imagine buying it.
You can't do that.
That is dreadful. I wonder if any. I'm sure people have done it, but oh dear.
Definitely, people have done it. On all formats to try and charge
in disguise.
Yeah, just walking into like your local Our Price in various outfits, looking like a character from Guess Who, just buying the same.
I reckon Madonna still does it.
Do you know what? It's really weird you say that.
The only explanation for songs getting it, she just goes in and buys every single one.
I can tell you how it happens because I went to see Madonna. About 6-7 years ago, she played Hyde Park, and growing up in the 80s, you know, like yourself, Madonna released some great pop music.
Yeah, definitely.
And then, as far as I'm concerned, she stopped releasing great pop music and started releasing stuff that didn't speak to me any longer. But I just thought Madonna's going to play. You know, I never got to see True Blue or Blonde Ambition or anything like that. So it's like, right, I'm going to go and watch Madonna and just so I can say I've seen Madonna play live. One of the worst gigs I've ever witnessed. It was truly awful. literally, when I bought the ticket, I think it was £90, but the full ticket price was something like £102.
Because hell.
You had to buy her new album Download as part of the ticket deal. So instantly, however many people are in Hyde Park, 30,000.
Like you two slipping their album into your iTunes.
Yeah.
Benched your will.
Yeah. So that album instantly was going to have 30,000 extra sales.
Which then, not that long ago, would have been a big deal.
Definitely. Probably would have took it to number one.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Yeah. Mad.
She...
Oh. She, now she looks like a thumb. It's... Her face has been so... stretched back. She's unrecognizable to me. The last couple of years, her face has just become like.
Yeah.
I don't like to do this, shaming people for the way they look, but she's gone a bit far.
Yeah.
I think she didn't need to do that. And it's really weird.
She didn't need to do anything. She's Madonna. Do you know what I mean? She's her legacy is there.
Odd now.
And it was so strange, Johnny. She just played pretty much her new album. And nobody was really that interested. And then I think she played like a little bit of, like started playing Like a Virgin, I think. And then after about a minute, merged it into like one of her new songs.
Oh, God.
And it was like, oh, man. And I think she played like maybe Ray of Light and she didn't play like Get Into the Groove, Papa Don't Preach, Open Your Heart, all of the really good pop songs.
You know what? I find that really... that shows a lot of disdain towards your audience.
Completely.
Completely sort of shits, especially for that ticket price. It's kind of shitting on people.
Yeah.
You should be giving people, fair enough, play some new songs, but you should also do a good deal of your favourites.
Definitely.
If you're an artist like that. That's out of order.
It is out of order, mate. And the weirdest thing was, at the end, she walked off stage and it was like, right, what's going to be the encore? And it was like, diddly-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee. And I thought, Holiday, amazing. She's going to play Holiday. And then the lights come up on the audience and the video, the pop video of Holiday come up on the screens and that was it.
What?
She didn't play it. It was just the video on screens to like soundtrack you walk out of Hyde Park.
That's kind of like... saying, I can do this, isn't it? I don't care about you, I can do this. That's what that says to me. It's just like, that's two fingers at the audience, I think.
But
saying, I'm Madonna and I can do this if I want. I could have done this for my whole gig. I could have played you videos. And you wouldn't.
I wish you would have. I would have had a better time.
Yeah.
Track five, Johnny, the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing.
Oh, this one was easy. This comes from an album which soundtracked those years as well. It's Don't Fight It, Feel It by Primal Scream.
Wonderful.
So 1991-ish. I mean, that really, really, it reminds me being absolutely arsed on ecstasy in clubs. Just really, really hitting the ceiling to that song.
Yeah.
It is so, so good. But that whole entire album is amazing.
Yeah.
But that song. And I realised when I wrote this that three people involved in making that record are now gone.
Yeah.
Passed away. Denise Williams, Johnson very recently.
Yeah.
Weatherall. Andrew Weatherall at the beginning of the year, and Robert Young died a few years ago. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, really weird.
It's.
But, yeah. And sad.
Yeah.
But what a song.
What an album.
A song to leave behind. Yeah. I mean, that album definitely was my clubbing album, getting ready to go out album as well. Definitely.
So, where was clubbing in 91?
I think you know.
It was the Toothbrush then?
Yeah, I'd have been going there quite a lot. Definitely.
Yeah.
So I've just admitted to taking drugs in your club.
Right. Podcast is over, mate. Finished.
I had to do something to make it good.
I'm definitely over now.
No, but yeah. Don't do that, kids, by the way. Yeah.
So,
and if you do, drink plenty of water, but not too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. So be sensible. Be sensible.
Did you find ecstasy a complete revelation? Like, you know, it's very well documented that point of time, that second summer of love, I guess, and you know, that fusion of electronic music and guitar music and stuff. Like, was that a real jolt for you?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was the first time, I think, that guitar music and dance music started to become the same kind of thing.
You'd
go to like raves and stuff, and they would put in things like Sympathy for the Devil, you know, during their set. So it was kind of getting there.
Yeah.
And then that album, Screamadelica, kind of was a statement of intent, really. It kind of changed everything, I think, especially in dance music. That album had a massive, massive impact.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah, it's kind of with that, we've got that guitar indie and sort of dance thing.
Yeah.
I think the one thing they both had in common, weirdly, was mod.
Yeah.
Raves to me were like mod all nighters that they used to have in the 60s, where they would take loads of speed and just dance all night.
Yeah.
And it was a very, very similar culture. And indie had that as well, and they kind of met on the dance floor, didn't they? And it wasn't just them, it was lads. So it's the first time, you know, people on the terraces were starting to take heat watching football teams.
Yeah.
And they got into it. It changed. It really did. That little drug changed culture quite drastically,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
For quite a while. Then I think it just sort of, like everything like that, it started to go south. Because people start making money, the quality of what people are selling starts to dip, people start dying. So, yeah. God, this has got serious.
Well, let's take it back to Essex for track six, Johnny. Favourite song from an artist from your home county?
Oh, this again, this was easy. It would be, well, it wasn't easy. I'll tell you why, because I was born in Wiltshire.
Oh, okay.
Then I spent some time in Germany, but most of my life's been in London, but I spent growing up, most of my growing up years were spent in Essex. So I'm going to go for Essex. Because if it's Wiltshire, I can only think of Peter Gabriel again.
He's had his moment with his sledgehammer.
Yeah, with his... Oh, dear. I'm never going to live... I'm going to hear a big... Oh, I shouldn't have said this. I'm going to be hearing about this all the time now. The Peter Gabriel knob theory. Depeche Mode, Enjoy the Silence.
Wonderful.
That simple. Again, great song. I think it had a massive impact as well. It was around that same time, wasn't it? Early 90s, late 80s, very late 80s, maybe 89,
I think
it was
89.
Yeah. Amazing. The great thing about this song, I've got a little story about this, is that I went to Southend Technical College after school and did the same course as Dave Garn did, because he went to this as well, went to the same college as me, did the same course as me, and apparently, according to the lecturer I had then, in my first year, we both sat in the same place.
Really?
Yeah. So that chair, that place, must be blessed in some way. So that kind of spot, it's right near Halfords, for anyone who wants to know where this is. It was above Halfords, this annex, yeah, where I used to study graphics. It was at Halfords, which is right by the Victoria Underpass. Right, that spot there, for some reason, it's like the South End sort of success spot.
I like
you go there and sit there.
I like to think that chair now is a deck chair, and you get the cloak and the crown whenever you sit in it now.
That would be awesome, wouldn't it? Yeah. on the beach.
Yeah, totally.
Covered in rubbish.
So, were Mode a big band for you in general, like before like Violator stuff?
Weirdly, they weren't before that song. I mean, obviously, they were a huge band. They were a massive arena band. So I knew about them, and I liked synth music, and I love synth pop. They were never a band I got heavily into and actually bought their albums, just maybe listened to singles. But that song was, for me, a turning point with them, when I started to go, no, this band, that's amazing, because it is an incredible tune. Really, really good. And I started to sort of delve back into their past a bit more after that song. So came into them a bit Johnny-come-lately. But, yeah, that record is awesome. And, of course, there is the Garn-Dean connection.
Yes.
So I'd like to go in there, actually, and see that, and maybe get a blue plaque put up.
For you or for Garn?
For both of us.
The Garn-Dean.
You can share it with me. I don't mind, Dave. You can share a plaque with me.
So was that the... Was that also the art college that Jake Shillingford went to as well?
Oh, it possibly is, yeah.
Because his dad was a lecturer, I believe, at Southend Tech.
There were only two real sort of sixth form colleges at that point. I mean, there's a uni there now. Mm. It's a uni town, isn't it, now? Mm. But back then there was just Southend Tech. And then a bit away out of Southend, there was another place called Civic.
Yeah, Benfleet.
So you either went there or you went to Southend Tech. But yeah, the art department at Tech was much, much better. So I would have thought, yeah, he did. Okay. So it's obviously quite a blessed place.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But I do remember that being a big deal. I guess with art students it is anyway, but music was a very big deal to everyone, I think, at that college.
I think everybody, you know, if you grew up in Essex, everybody's got some sort of Depeche Mode story that's very loose, very loose.
Oh, mine's not loose.
No, yours
mine's,
is legit. Yours is legit.
Solid. Come on.
But my greatest one, is that the amount of people that claim to have, I'm interested in if you was there, people claimed to have been at Pearl Jam at the Esplanade. And
people claim to have been there? people do that? What? You're taking the piss, mate. That's not something people do. I would keep that quiet, personally.
I weren't there.
Is that a thing?
Like, massively. I mean, they played there when just as Alive come out, and obviously just ahead of them being stadium, you know, fillers for forever. And they played the Esplanade, which I don't know if you played the Esplanade. Right.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's a small,
yeah,
regular small long room, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not very big venues. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, and that's just quite cool.
I've met about 500 people that claim to have been there.
It'd be better if it was Nirvana, but, you know, I guess, you know. But you've got to remember, Stuart, that whole grunge I would never have been seen dead going to a grunge gig at the time. The only grunge album I ever got and listened to and thought, yeah, this is quite good, was the Nirvana album, yeah. Nevermind. The rest of grunge, just I couldn't get into it.
Have you since explored it? Like,
of course, we tried to kill it, and we did. I think
undeniably, what happened in the mid 90s with the term Britpop was it did definitely take the especially in the obviously in the UK, it took the shine and the attention away from what was predominantly alternative music was being governed by what was coming over from America.
Yeah, I think also the death of Cobain in 1994 kind of helped. That was like a nail in the coffin as well for that scene, because that's when we kind of took all the bands, that Britpop bands, really started to go, right, this is our moment, I guess. But yeah,
before I just get to the last track, Johnny, just. On that moment there, when you said the Britpop band started to kind of, the trajectory really sort of started to hit, like, how did you find that? Obviously you mentioned you didn't like walking past Tower Records and seeing your face in the window, but because of the pop sensibilities of a lot of your records, you was not just, Melody Maker and NME, Smash Hits loved you and things like that. Yeah. And it was like, how did you find the attention?
It's a double-edged sword, anything like that. Obviously, it's good because you're selling records and that's your job. But for someone like me who's on the autistic spectrum, it can be very problematic, and it just had the effect of making me withdraw even more, because I used to get so much shit from people. All the time when I went out, that I just got tired of it. And I got tired of the amount of press we were doing. I started to think that this is overkill. This isn't me slagging off the people who did our press or anything, because they did a stellar job. But for me, I started to think it was a bit too much. I felt that we were, for what we were, which was basically just a little indie pop band, the ambition behind what the record label wanted us to be was a bit too much. Like, they were expecting us to do Blur immediately. They expected us to do Part Life straight away, and they totally forgot that Blur had to do Leisure and Modern Life is Rubbish before they got to Part Life.
Yeah.
But they expected us to be Part Life immediately, which that's a big ask for a band that have only been together for like 6 hours.
Yeah.
So,
and that's not an exaggeration either, is
no,
it?
No, it's not. It's really not. It really isn't. So, and that's a shame, because that's when really that whole thing really became the controlling factor in success. Is if your first record, album, single, whatever, didn't do particularly well, that was it for you. You were dropped. There was no developing artists over time.
Yeah.
And I would have... If I could do it again, I would think along those terms more and probably say no to a lot more things.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that's what Menzo was about. It was about that flash, like a flash of sort of brilliance and then poof, gone.
Yeah.
And I also think, I've spoken to the others, and one thing I've said to them is we should have split up after Being Brave. We should have just gone, fuck it. And left on that as it hit top 10 and just done the one album and then gone and done other stuff. Maybe that would have been a better way of doing it, but you can't. That's when you're looking back, it's easy to say. At the time, you're really young and it's your job and you're paying bills and stuff, and that's what you're worried about more than anything. So,
okay. Final track, Johnny. This is when you get to play DJ. A song that many may not know. That you would like them to hear.
I find this really difficult as well.
It's not necessarily got to be an obscure song or anything. Just
I'll tell you what. There's an artist. I can't remember her name, but she's a really good. She's hip hop artist. And she's called Leigh Kelly. Have you heard of her? Leigh Kelly 47, I think. Let me just look, so I'm probably completely wrong. Yeah, Leigh Kelly 47. And she did this song called Girl Blunt, which is awesome. So I'd say at the moment, listen to that. And you probably won't expect me to say listen to that, but I'm kind of quite into my female hip-hop artists, and I've been for a bit, because they seem to be making really good stuff that no one else is doing as well. And that song is really, really good. So that one.
Well, we put together a Spotify playlist to accompany this with all the tracks that we've spoken about, so I'll ensure that that is on there. Johnny, I've really enjoyed chatting. I knew this would be a fun chat, because when we finished doing Hardcore Listening on the drive home, Chris and I was like, that was a lot of fun. And the reaction we had to that podcast was great. And
excellent.
And yeah, thank you so much for your time today, mate.
You got me to talk about Peter Gabriel's Todger. So, what more could anyone want? Seriously, come on.
Johnny, thanks so much, mate.
Thank you. Pleasure.
There you go. I told you you'd enjoy that. Just a top fella, Johnny. Really, really, like, it's the second time that I've sat and chatted records with Johnny. As mentioned at the beginning, if you do get a chance, head over to the Hardcore Listening podcast and check out Johnny talking about David Bowie records. And we didn't, I purposely didn't go into it again on this podcast, because we'd had that conversation on the Hardcore Listening chat. But go and find out why we speak about why a Menswear film would be absolutely crackers, because we go into it on that podcast about the journey and how it was, so much of it was telling people they were in a band before they were even in a band, and having to play to every record company in the country with literally two songs that they had to write on the quick. It's a really mad insight into what almost appears to be a blag, but then, you know, out of that comes some great pop records. That's all discussed there. And like I say, if you enjoy listening to people talking about that kind of mid-90s period of Britpop and such, then in the archives there's bundles of people that, you know, had incredible commercial success, you know, like Johnny did throughout that period. So go and get lost in some of them chats over there. That's me done. You can find out about everything at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Have a lovely week, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year, and they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast, and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.